Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Parent Factors with your host, Dr. John DeGarmo. Today, families are a lot different than they were in the past. So whether you have one child or you're part of a blended family, you can depend on Dr. John for weekly insights, answers, tips, and solutions. Now, the world of parenting is right at your fingertips. Here's Dr. John.
Are you one of those parents who struggle with having children sleeping in their home? Do you struggle yourself with a sleeping child that's keeping you up at night? Let me tell you, over the past 13 years, my wife and I have had over 50 children come through our home. 50 children through foster care, through adoption, through biological, whatever it may be. And there have been those nights when we have not been able to sleep. A crying baby, a crying child, a crying teenager, whatever it may be, somebody is usually always awake in our home. My wife and I often joke that we will sleep when we get to heaven because there have been so many sleepless nights. In fact, I have two children right now, just last night, had a hard time sleeping, tossing and turning in their bed and in their crib, and it kept me up. Maybe you have that same challenge in your own home. Well, our special guest this week on Parent Factors with Dr. John is Dr. Robert Rosenberg. He is the leading expert in the nation on the field of sleep medicine. In fact, he has his own radio show called HealthLife.net. I'm sorry, it's on the radio network HealthLife.net called Answers for Sleep. And he is the author of the best-selling book, Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day, A Doctor's Guide to Solving Your Sleep Problems. Calling in all the way from Arizona is our special guest this week, Dr. Robert Rosenberg. Bob, welcome to the program this week.
John, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, Bob, I have had those nights where I'm having children tossing and turning in their sleep, and it's really kept my wife and I up. You have a chapter in your book devoted to children's sleep issues. So let's start right off. I've had other foster parents ask me, like, as I travel across the nation, if it's okay if they have their foster baby sleep in bed with them. How do you feel about co-sleeping with an infant?
At the age, most of the studies have shown if the child is less than 4 months, there's a significant danger, increased danger of sudden infant death syndrome in co-sleeping. I don't mean staying in the bedroom. I'm talking about co-sleeping in the bed. And so I know the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I tend to agree, because one study showed a 5 times higher increase incidence of SIDS in children who co-sleep with their parents. So I have my own granddaughter, and my daughter in Chicago is doing that, and I insisted, finally, I said, well, at least let's get some kind of a bassinet you can put in the bed, so that you don't roll over on the baby and that we don't get the baby wedged between bedding, and this is what happens. So eventually she listened to me, but my feeling is before 4 months, I would really avoid co-sleeping in terms of in the same bed as the mother or father.
Oh, that's good to hear. I was thinking the same exact thing. Good to know that I'm on the right page. So when can we expect then an infant to sleep through the night? You know, the baby comes home from the hospital, and mom and dad are not going to get a good night's sleep that first night. When can they start getting a good night's sleep? When can that baby start doing that?
It's sleep duration. So we know that initially in the first 2 months or so, or up to about 3 months, children don't sleep any longer than about 3 to 4 hours, and then they get hungry, and then they go, you know, and they sleep and on and off, and they have no sleep-wake schedule. There's no relationship to any circadian cycle of night and day. At 3 months, we start to see some children beginning to sleep up to 6 hours, and some may even begin to sleep through the night. At 6 months, it's much more likely, and most studies show that by 9 months, 75 to 80% of children are sleeping through the night without, and by that we mean they're not at request having to get up in the middle of the night for feedings and things like that. So most parents can see some improvement by 3 months, and by 6 months, hopefully, you know, you're getting your sleep because your child is sleeping in 6 to 8 hours at a time.
Oh, 6 to 8 hours at a time. That sounds That sounds glorious. You know, Bob, my wife and I, at our first child, we wanted to save the world. We wanted to help the environment. So we thought we would do cloth diapers. And let me tell you, I was up, I think maybe every 20 minutes, half an hour, changing the diapers. And then by the time we got to our second child, we thought, well, forget that. You know, forget that. But still, there are those times where the baby is still crying in the night. When should parents let a baby cry it out, so to speak, or should they get up and comfort that prom sleeper throughout the night? Just last night, Bob, I've got a 1-year-old in my house right now who came to me from foster care with a variety of issues and a variety of anxieties. And every single night, Bob, every night, he wakes up and cries and cries and cries. Should parents let that baby cry it out, or should they comfort?
The Ferber is the one who came up with the crying it out, and there's been a lot of studies. Some studies have shown it doesn't do any harm, but other studies have shown that may not be the case, that it may lead to anxiety and separation anxiety, even in babies. I'm more of a believer of graduated extinction, which means you go into the room and you don't pick the baby up, but, you know, you show him your face, you talk to him, and you do that. Initially, you might wait 5 minutes before going into the bedroom during the first night, and then after a few nights, you might wait up to 10 minutes before you go in and you do that, and you gradually withdraw your presence. But I think that's the way to do it. It's too difficult for most parents to just sit there and let the baby scream and posture. And I'm not so sure that's good for the children. And most studies have shown that the graduated extinction method, and there's another method called fading, where you try to put the baby to sleep when he's really sleepy. Let's say his actual sleep time is 8 o'clock is when he falls asleep. So about 8 o'clock, you put him into the bed, and then you have some type of a routine, a positive routine, a bedtime routine, and that the baby then will begin to associate with falling asleep because you're putting him into bed at a time when he's sleepy. And the key to this whole thing is to let the children self-soothe themselves to sleep. And so, but no, I don't believe in letting babies cry it out, although there may be people out there, and there are studies that say that it's okay to do that, and that there's no significant problems associated with it, but I'm just not so sure about that.
I got two questions based on that answer there, Bob. First of all, you said that not to pick the baby up, but instead just show the baby your face and some calming words. Why not pick the baby up when it's crying in the middle of the night?
Because they begin to develop a sleep onset association disorder where they have to associate you picking them up and rocking them and so on with sleep. So the idea of these techniques is to try to break that gradually and gently. So I'm not saying the idea, at least when it was written and has been written about, in most of these techniques, they recommend you come in, you reassure the baby that when he cries, you're there, you've come in, but to pick them up, to let them fall asleep in your arms, which is what happens in many cases when you sit down in a chair or rocker and they fall asleep in your arms, and then you put them back into the bassinet of the crib. What's happening is they're associating you picking them up and rocking them with falling asleep, and that's the problem with a lot of these children, babies, and it goes on even to the age of 3 or 4, is they don't learn how to self-soothe themselves to sleep, and that's what we're trying to teach.
Now that brings up my second question: self-soothe. How does an infant learn to self-soothe, and what does that look like?
Well, self-soothing means we teach them to self-soothe by basically not letting them fall asleep in our arms. We want to hold them before bedtime. We want to have some type of a gentle routine, but we try to avoid them falling asleep in our arms. We try to put them into bed as they're quieting down and then let them put themselves to sleep. And that's what is meant by self-soothing, as opposed to you or providing a stimulus which allows the baby to fall asleep, such as rocking them or some type of physical contact or bringing them into your own bed. Then you defeat the purpose, and the child does not learn to self-soothe, or in other words, doesn't learn how to fall asleep on their own.
You know, we hear a lot about babies with pacifiers, babies not having pacifiers. Is it okay, Bob, to send a baby to bed with a pacifier?
I think it is, and most of the studies have said it is. Up to about the age of 6 months, pacifiers do seem to decrease the incidence, again, of sudden infant death syndrome. They are a way of baby self-soothing. After 6 months, however, it can become a problem. There's an increased incidence of ear infections in some studies with pacifiers. So most of us recommend that by 6 months or to a year, you know, you begin to withdraw the pacifier gently. But I don't think there's a problem with giving the baby a pacifier when they go to bed, except for the first few weeks. If you're trying to get them to breastfeed, you want to learn them. You want to learn how to grab onto the mother's nipple as opposed to the pacifier. So normally we hold off on the pacifier if you're going to be breastfeeding for at least the first 6 to 8 weeks.
Right, right. Now, Bob, we had a 9-year-old boy come into foster care to our home, to our family, and let me tell you, he was a chainsaw. That young fellow could snore like I've never heard before. Should it be a concern if a child snores?
If a child snores habitually, meaning regularly, almost every night, it's a concern to the point where the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children who snore habitually be evaluated for sleep apnea. Now, the evaluation might not necessarily mean a sleep study, but it means careful examination and questioning by the pediatrician as to whether or not the child might have sleep apnea, because sleep apnea is very common. 12% of children snore, but 4% have sleep apnea. And if the sleep apnea goes undiagnosed, and it frequently does, it can lead to developmental problems and behavioral problems, and children presenting as if they were hyperactive, and they're misdiagnosed as having ADHD when they really don't have anything of that kind whatsoever.
Right, right. Now, Bob, let's talk about your own experience as a parent. What led you to becoming a sleep expert? Were you having problems with your own children sleeping at night, or was this something that you were always interested in?
Well, I started off as a pulmonary specialist for adults, and I was a pulmonary critical care doctor, and where I was living, part of the state of Arizona at that time, there were no sleep specialists, and the closest sleep labs were, 150 miles away. So I began to get interested in sleep, and I was taking care of mainly adult patients with sleep disorders. And then I decided to really get involved in the field of sleep, give up pulmonary critical care. I became a sleep specialist. I became board certified. And then I was the only person in the area who had any knowledge of sleep and even of children. So I began seeing the pediatric patients in my sleep practice about 15, 20 years ago. And just basically after that, I still do. I have a mixture of adults and pediatrics. I do both, but I love doing the children because, unfortunately, there's not many sleep specialists out there who do children. Actually,
right.
A lot of sleep specialists limit their practices to adults only, which is unfortunate.
Sure, I imagine so. So, as a parent, what kind of sleep disorders can a child have, and how would a parent like myself? No. What would we look for in regards to perhaps a sleep disorder in our own children?
Sure. The first thing is the child irritable and fatigued during the day? Is the child hyperactive? Frequently, hyperactivity and problems with impulse control may be related to a sleep disorder. So that's some of the symptoms of it. It would be fatigue, cognitive problems in school, inability to pay attention, inability to focus. So the first thing you as a parent want to figure out is, okay, how much sleep is my child getting? And do I understand that, 7 to 8 hours for my wife and myself might be fine, but 7 to 8 hours for a 6-year-old is totally unacceptable. They need more like 10 to 11 hours of sleep. And if they're not getting that amount of sleep, there's a good chance that they're going to start to present with the symptoms I just talked about, cognitive problems, hyperactivity, irritability, moodiness, anxiety. So those are some of the things we look for. Then the other thing is your child, does your child snore? If your child has symptoms of cognitive problems and hyperactivity and they snore constantly or every night, there's a good chance they might have sleep apnea. So you need to look into that. And if you need to consider the environment, if you have a television in your baby in your child's room, a 6- or 7-year-old, you may not think he's doing this, but he may be getting up at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning and turning the television on, and may only be getting 4, 5, or 6 hours of sleep. I have children who come to me all the time, and parents are amazed when I tell them to take the television out of the bedroom, and they're also amazed to find out how after we get the television out of the bedroom, frequently the symptoms go away because the child is sleeping a normal amount of time that he should be sleeping.
Right, I imagine. Yeah, I've had I've had children come to my home where their parents demand that a television be placed into the child's bedroom or a DVD, a VCR, and my wife and I have always steadfastly said no to that. You know, just
good.
That, for the reasons you just said that. Bob, we have to take a break. I'd like to talk to you. I'd like to talk to you when we get back about sleeping, about some more sleeping disorders. We're listening to Parent Factors with Dr. John. Our special guest this week is Dr. Robert Rosenberg. We'll be back after these messages.
We'll be back with Parent Factors and Dr. John right after these messages.
Greetings. My name is Daniel Heimpel, and I'm the publisher of The Chronicle of Social Change, an online news site covering child welfare and juvenile justice. Be sure to check out our money and business section, which includes a huge database of youth services funding opportunities from private foundations and all levels of government. Thanks for taking a look at chronicleofsocialchange.org.
Did you ever wish there was a manual for foster parents? Well, now there is. This manual is a comprehensive guide offering proven, friendly advice for novice and experienced parents alike. Distilling many years' experience into one book, U.S. foster and adoptive parent John DeGarmo combines his own hard-won wisdom with that of fellow foster parents. He describes what to expect from the process, how to access help and support, and how to ensure the best care for your child. The Foster Parenting Manual, available now in stores and at Amazon.com.
Welcome to the award-winning Fostering Families Today magazine. Foster parents are called to give their hearts, share their homes, and make a difference in the life of a child. The journey is difficult and filled with heartbreak and loss, but also joys and inspiration as they see the children in their care make small changes or large accomplishments. Fostering Families Today has been ministering to the hearts of those families for 15 years, celebrating the joys, educating for the future, and sharing in the bumps and bruises of the fostering journey. It's more than a magazine. It's a training tool, a therapeutic intervention, and a friend to lean on. Let Fostering Families Today be part of your journey. Find us on the internet at www.adoptinfo.net or call for additional information toll-free at 888-924-6736.
An insightful, interesting new book called Fostering Love, available at Amazon or where you buy books. John DeGarmo learns that to follow God's call in his life means to take up his cross in his own home. This book is a true life account of his experience as a foster parent, along with his wife and their own three children, as he followed God's call to take foster children into his home. This is a story of heartbreak, sadness, and ultimate love as he comes to find God in the tears and smiles of many foster children. Fostering Love by Dr. John DeGarmo.
Did you know there are more than 400,000 children in foster care? Foster, adoptive, and kinship caregivers stand in the gap for these children, and they need support too. The National Foster Parent Association has been the voice of foster, adoptive, and kinship caregivers for more than 40 years, advocating for thousands of families who open their heart and homes to children in need. Learn more about NFPA at www.nfpaonline.org or call 1-800-557-5238.
And now back to Dr. John and Parent Factors.
Parent Factors with Dr. John, and our special guest this week is a national sleep expert, Dr. Robert Rosenberg. So, Bob, how does lack of sleep affect a child's development? We've talked many times in this program how drugs can affect a child's development or moving from home to home to home and thus missing a lot of school can affect a child's development. But how does the lack of sleep do that?
Lack of sleep actually affects a child's brain development, especially before the age of three. We have two studies that have come out in the last 5 years, one out of Canada in 2008, that found that toddlers, children under three who slept less than 10 hours, had learning disabilities and an increased incidence of ADHD that persisted many years after the age of three, and even when they returned to what would be considered a normal amount of sleep for the age group they were then in. Then another study in England, the Millennium Study, same thing. They found that children who had irregular bedtimes before the age of three and were getting less than than 11 hours of sleep, ended up having learning disabilities, problems with language, and they persisted even after the age of 7. So it's during sleep, especially in a very young brain, that during different stages of sleep, the areas of the brain develop. So during slow wave sleep is when areas of the higher cortex develop in response actually to the delta waves or the slow waves that are being emitted during sleep. And as the same thing with REM sleep. During REM sleep, before the age of 3, it appears that REM sleep has a lot to do with developing the occipital cortex or the visual cortex. So there's a direct correlation between the development of the brain and tangible changes that occur in response to various brain electrical patterns that go on during sleep. And if your child's not getting enough sleep, there's especially an attenuation of deep sleep or REM sleep, there's a good chance that they're going to suffer as a result intellectually.
Yeah, I never knew that. That's very, very interesting. So how can, well, let me ask a question differently.
Sure.
What
sure.
can cause an infant or a small child not to get the sleep that he so sounds like desperately needs? You talked about TV, but what other distractions might cause a child to not get the sleep he needs?
Well, the TV is one thing, but the big problem we're having with toddlers and with older children is school-age children are interactive electronics, cell phones, texting, all of that stuff. Anything that emits blue light is going to depress the melatonin production from the brain and inhibit the ability to fall asleep. And in younger children, even in babies, the environment, the temperature in the room, everything needs to be considered. We want it dark. We want it quiet. We want it peaceful. We want to have a regular bedtime routine. We don't want a lot of vigorous activity right before we try to put a baby to bed or a younger child to bed. We're going to be raising the body temperature. We're stimulating them too much. They'll have trouble falling asleep. They'll have trouble staying asleep. So those are some of the things that we – and, of course, if you have a child who's really a young child or who's having difficulty, always make sure there isn't some medical problem. Make sure there isn't a thyroid problem or some type of an endocrine problem. Bring it to the attention of your pediatrician. Make sure the child is thoroughly worked up for anything else, a pain or anything. Or a lot of children have restless leg syndrome and they don't know how to express it. So we're told they're growing pains. When we now know the majority of children who were told, parents were told they were growing pains, most of the time it actually turned out to be restless leg syndrome.
Wow. Yeah. Now, Bob, let's talk about adults and parents. My wife and I have had up to 11 children in our home at one time. Right now, we're down to a very, very quiet 8, it seems like. And if there's anything I want for Christmas, it's probably a good night's sleep, which we really don't get. Well, how many hours should an adult get per night?
According to the National Sleep Foundation, an average adult, young adult, middle-aged adult should be getting between 7 to 9 hours of sleep. That's pretty much the recommendations of the NSF, and I'm in total agreement. I've written about that in my book, and we discussed that. We know that when adults get less than 6 hours, we start to see a real spike in high blood pressure and heart disease and stroke at earlier ages and earlier mortality. So there's a definite reason for stating 7 to 9 hours is probably the best amount of sleep for most people. Sure, there are exceptions to the rule. There's 5% of the population that can get by on less than 4 or 5 hours of sleep, but they're really rare people. And those of us who are trying to burn the candle at both ends and are only getting by on 5-6 hours of sleep a night for long periods of time, we're on our way to diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease and obesity, because lack of sleep does result in obesity.
How is that? How does that work? How does lack of sleep lead to obesity?
When you don't get enough sleep, your body produces excessive amounts of a hormone called ghrelin, which is produced in the lining of the stomach. And ghrelin stimulates appetite. So the body does two things. It produces too much ghrelin, which stimulates the appetite, and also when ghrelin levels are very high, we tend to eat a lot of carbohydrates. Two, we don't produce enough leptin, which is a appetite-suppressing hormone that when we get insufficient sleep is found to be in very low levels. So you've got the combination of too much ghrelin, not enough leptin, you've got a voracious appetite, and then on top of that, since you're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours or 6, you're probably fatigued, you don't exercise, you have no energy, you come home, you plop down in the chair, and that's it. And then you start to munch in front of the TV. So what happens is these people develop obesity and lack of sleep, but we do know the hormonal changes that result in lack of sleep and result in the obesity.
Well, you talked about obesity, and you talked about some other physical problems that may happen. What are some of the emotional or mental problems that might arise from lack of sleep?
Oh, that's a great question. I've got a book coming out this spring, which is going to be devoted to anxiety and stress and depression and how it relates to sleep. So we know that when people have chronic insomnia and don't get enough sleep, the incidence of depression following that after a period of a year or two is extremely high, possibly 20 or 30%. We also know that when you don't get enough sleep, you don't do well with stress. Literally, studies have shown that when people don't get enough sleep, when they get only 5 hours of sleep or so, they react to stressors in an extreme manner, as opposed to a control group that got 8 hours of sleep, who may not even react in any way to these experimental stressors. So people actually, when they don't get enough sleep, they tend to have problems with people's facial expressions. And children especially have that problem. A person may have a perfectly neutral facial expression, but when you're sleep deprived, you look at it as negative. You may take a kind word the wrong way. You become irritable. So we know that lack of sleep definitely affects moods. And if you do have chronic depression or anxiety and you don't get enough sleep, there's a good chance you're not going to respond to the treatment for your depression or anxiety until you get that sleep issue resolved.
Now, Bob, I understand you just did a presentation on your latest research, pregnancy and sleep.
Right.
So for all of those pregnant mothers out there who are listening, can you give us a few important things that those pregnant mothers need to know about their sleep at night?
Yeah, make especially in the third trimester, try to make sleep a priority. We have found that in several studies that have come out recently that women who were sleep deprived significantly during the third trimester, and of course in the first month or so after the birth, postpartum, have the highest incidence of postpartum depression. So postpartum depression is a real problem in this country. It occurs in about 16% of women. And when you look at the women who develop postpartum depression, we find that sleep or lack of sleep or insomnia during the last trimester and during the first 4 weeks after the birth of the baby can predict postpartum depression and is an independent cause for that. The other thing is sleep apnea. 10% of women who are pregnant have sleep apnea, and we now know that sleep apnea is a major cause of hypertension, diabetes, and intrauterine growth retardation during pregnancy. So if you're snoring loudly and you have high blood pressure or diabetes or preeclampsia, make sure that you get tested for sleep apnea because it can be controlled, and it's very important not only to you but to the development of the baby in your uterus.
So, Bob, your book, Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day, A Doctor's Guide to Sleeping Your Sleep Problems. Bob, where can readers buy your book?
Sure. It's available on Amazon, has been for quite a while now. It came out last year. So if you go to Amazon.com, you can get either the Kindle version or the soft cover version of Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. It's also been available on Barnes & Noble as well. So those are the two major places you can get the book.
And if they want to find out more about what you do or about sleep in general,
sure.
How can we contact you? Where can we find you?
We have a website called AnswersForSleep.com, which is a rather large website just devoted to sleep. If you go on there, you'll see various topics I've written about, talked about, and actual lectures I've given. In addition to that, if you write a question, we do our best to try to answer all sleep-related questions within a week or so. So we do our best to answer them and post them, and the website is AnswersForSleep.com.
AnswersForSleep.com. Hey, Bob, I'm so grateful for you taking time to be on our program this evening. I learned a lot about sleep myself, and I'm going to try to put some of your things into practice tonight with some of my children.
That's wonderful, John. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure. The book, again, is called Sleep Soundly Every Night, Feel Fantastic Every Day. Bob, one more time, what's the name of that website?
AnswersForSleep.com.
AnswersForSleep.com. Okay, great. All right, we need to wrap up another episode of Parent Factors with Dr. John this week. I'm so glad you joined us. Hopefully you took something away from this great, great interview tonight, and you are going to have maybe the best night's sleep you've had in a long time. It is so important. I love the title of this book, sleep soundly every night, feel fantastic every day, because it's so very true. In order to be a healthy parent, in order to be a healthy person, a healthy spouse, a healthy partner, you need to make sure you're getting a good night's sleep every night. That's it. With Dr. John, catch me on my website, Dr. John Foster Care Expert, and as well as social media. Till next week, I bid you cheers.